Evening all. So, short introduction on tonight's guest. Really someone that has been involved in pretty much every musical magazine and paper since the 70s, worked on Sounds and the NME, started working at Smash Hits in 79, I believe.
Yeah.
Then, just 17, 1983, sort of involved in setting up Q in 1986, Empire in 1988, Mojo in 93, The Mighty Word magazine in 2003. If that wasn't enough, he was also a presenter on the Whistle Test for most of the 80s. As well as being one of the main anchors on the Live Aid coverage that was on BBC One. And as well as all that, he's recently written a couple of books, which Simon was talking about earlier on, which we're going to be talking about, obviously, during the night. 1971, about the music from 1971, and also about the disappearing tribe of rock stars, which we'll start talking about in just a moment. But if you could just put your hands together, please, and give a Glossop Record Club welcome for Mr. David Hepworth.
Lovely to see you all. Are you all comfortable? I'm worried about people standing over there. Are you going to be all right? Okay. I should be looking nervously at you.
So, David, let's start, if we may, with your latest tome.
My latest tome.
Uncommon
People.
The
book, What I Wrote.
A book, What You Wrote. For anyone who hasn't read it yet, can you give us a little overview? And
well, I just wanted to write, you know, I'd written the 1971 book, which did really well. And so they said, we want another one. And so I said, well, I wanted to write a book about rock stars because I don't think anybody's written a book about rock stars. I was interested in the kind of the characteristics of the social tribe that we know as rock stars, because I think they're sort of our fantasy friends. We acquire them as fantasy friends generally when we're about 13 or 14 years old, not thinking that when we reach our 40s, our 50s, and our 60s, and our 70s, they're still going to be there. And we're still going to be kind of measuring ourselves against them. And it struck me as I sat down to write this book, you don't actually have any rock stars anymore. I think rock stars finished in the mid-90s. Because I think musical eras tend to be 40 years. I think jazz, from the end of the First World War to the end of the 50s. You know, I think rock and roll, from the mid-50s to the mid-90s. Right now, we're probably in the second decade or even the third decade of the era of hip-hop. Mm. And then it'll be something else afterwards, you know. And so I was intrigued at who these people were. You know, who were the people who became rock stars? What did the experience of them becoming rock stars do to them as people? And what does our choice of them as rock stars say about us? Because we have a great part in this. Because, you know, a rock star, you know, people say, what are the defining characteristics? Well, it's not leather trousers and looking like Nick Kent or anything like that, you know. Because rock stars come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. And it's not even being able to play a 12-bar blues or trying to bring down society or anything like that. The defining characteristics of rock star, in my experience, is people always say, if I went for a drink with him or her, we'd really get on. They don't say that about movie stars. They don't say that about novelists. They don't say that about footballers. It's something about the relationship with the rock star that we feel some kind of personal connection with them. Mm. And it's that kind of thing I wanted to explore in the book. So what I've done is there's 40 years of rock stars, and what I've done is I've just focused on one person on one day in each of those 40 years, going right through to my final rock star is Kurt Cobain, who's the person, you know, he died because he couldn't deal with the accumulated responsibilities and expectations of being a rock star. And so what I hope it'll do, you know, people say, oh, you haven't got so-and-so, you haven't got so-and-so. Well, I'm not trying to have everybody. I'm trying to be comprehensive. I'm trying to just build up the picture of how the idea of a rock star changed over those years. And so that reading it, hopefully, will be like looking at one of those flick books you used to look at as a child, where as the pages go by, you see the kind of stick figure of the rock star right through to Kurt Cobain. So that's the idea of the book.
And was it easy to choose who you included and who you didn't? I imagine it's, you know, like when you watch a crime drama on telly and they have the wall with photos and bits of red string and drawing pins. Was it kind of like that, working out
who
to put
in? Not so much like that. I mean, there's a few things that I changed. You know, there are a couple of chapters that I did in the kind of first version. Then we junked them. Mm. I could probably do an expanded edition on the Universal Records label, you know, with additional material.
Deluxe
there was
edition.
A chapter about Elvis Costello that was in there, and I took it out. And there was a chapter about a package tour in 1958, which I put in there, and I took it out. But, you know, there are people who aren't in there. You know, Chuck Berry's not in there. Morrissey's not in there. But I chose the people I wanted to write about. You know, it's a subjective history. I chose the people who personally fascinated me, who I felt I could tell some kind of story about and draw some kind of moral from their adventures. That's what I did. You know, it's personal history. Look, most rock and roll history nowadays is like most World War II history. It's written by people who weren't there. Okay, it's written by people who read about it afterwards. Well, you may find this difficult to credit looking at my boyish appearance and my entirely unlined countenance, but I was born in the year 1950, okay? Imagine that, ladies and gentlemen, in the years of black and white. And so, I mean, I'm taking advantage of the fact that I feel I got a unique perspective because, I, you know, as far as rock stars were concerned, I saw them all come and I saw them all go. You know, I counted them all out and I counted them back in again. And so, you know, I've got that point of view. And so that's what I stick to in my books. And I hope successfully.
Well, maybe we could start with your first chapter, which is about this colourful figure, Little Richard, who he had a strange upbringing. You say he was one of 10 children who, according to his mum, was more trouble than the rest of them put together. He had one eye bigger than the other, one leg shorter than the other. What were the ingredients that made him the first rock star?
Well, okay, that tells you a lot about rock stars, because in what other profession could you turn such apparent deficiencies into your kind of ace cards? And the story I tell in the book is when he goes to a studio in Rampart Street in New Orleans in 1955, and he hasn't had a hit. He's tried, you know, and he's known on the Chitlin circuit. And he's put in there with Bumps Blackwell, who's a very, you know, quite a well-known producer, sent from Los Angeles to produce a get-a-hit out of this guy. And they try various things in the studio, and nothing really works. And then they take a break at lunchtime, and they go across the road to the Dewdrop Inn. And Richard spots the piano, and just to amuse the band, he starts hammering on the piano and singing a song, a ditty, which he's confident will never be recorded because it's so filthy. It describes the mechanics of sexual practices that were at the time illegal in every one of the United States. And I wouldn't repeat any of them to in this august company this evening, but full details are in the book. you know, he sang this filthy song. And Bumps Blackwell, there's nothing more desperate than a producer who's got to get a hit out of a session. He says, "What's that?" He says, "It's just some shit I made up, you know." He said, "We should record that." He said, "You can't do that. The words are filthy." He said, "We'll fix that." And so he calls a woman called Dorothy Labostri, who is working in New Orleans at the time as a waitress, and she's a part-time kind of poet and would-be song lyric writer. And he says, "Get over here right now." And he says to Richard, "Sing that song to this lady." And Richard is mortified with embarrassment being expected to do this and insists that she turns around while he sings the song. Sings the song twice, she notes it down, and then 15 minutes later, she comes up with, you know, "Her name is Daisy, he almost drives me crazy," and all the bowdlerized, you know, lyrics with which we associate the record that started Little Richard's career. And in many senses, started rock and roll. Mm. And, you know, is the starting point of the first rock star. It's the sound that sounds like the guy looks. It's the look that sounds like the look of the record. Mm. That's the first rock star. Wah-bop-a-loom-a-blop-bop-bop-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-toot-a-to I think they just did two takes. That's all they had the time to do. It was the end of the session. And I think it's a classic case, classic proof, once again, that there is nothing in rock and roll that can't be made worse by being done again. Okay? You know, the less time you've got to do anything,
yeah.
I think this applies to creativity generally. The less time you got, the better it is. And you can hear the panic in the,
and the immediacy
in their delivery there. They're not going to get another go at this, you know.
And that record was, well, Little Richard was loved by Bowie as a kid, wasn't he?
I think Bowie says that, in recollects years later, that before Little Richard the world was black and white, and after Little Richard the world was Technicolor, you know. Mm. And Keith Richard was enthralled by Little Richard, and Bob Dylan, Robert Zimmerman, as he was at the time, you know, and probably 16 or something in Minnesota, in his high school yearbook, and he has to list his ambition, and everybody else says, you know, to be a doctor or whatever. He says to join Little Richard. It's the idea that Little Richard got a gang. And you know, the greatest aspiration was join Little Richard's gang, because what he was doing, nobody had done before. You know, that's why I chose him.
That's a great starting place. So, how much research goes into writing a book like this? I mean, there's some fascinating facts that I didn't know, like the that really bizarre one about Robert Plant finding out about Led Zeppelin reforming from reading a thing in Farmers Weekly.
Yes.
Or, you know, the Buddy Holly thing about having to do his laundry, and that was the reason he was
on the plane. Well, yeah, that's my... Buddy Holly, I think, is actually the most influential single figure in rock and roll. You know, the whole of the 60s, all those bands, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Creedence Clearwater Revival, it all starts with Buddy Holly, because they looked at Buddy Holly and thought, we could do that. It looks doable, you know what I mean? And he didn't look like Elvis Presley. He didn't look like Little Richard. He looked like the boy next door. And he sang about his girlfriends and movies he'd seen and so forth. And so he's a hugely inspirational figure. Tragically, his death comes about when he's on a tour, undertaking a tour of the least hospitable parts of the United States in the thick of winter. And he has to tour because, despite having hits all over the world, he's got no money because he's in dispute with his manager. And he's on this tour, and they're playing two shows a night. When they come off stage after the second show, they take off the clothes and they throw them in the back of the bus, and nothing gets laundered. And after a while, the back of the bus is stinking so badly. It smells so bad, even small boys remark upon it. And Buddy Holly decides that the only way he's going to get out of this is he's going to fly ahead after the gig to the next town in order to get his pants washed and get them back from the laundry to the show that evening.
Beyonce doesn't do that, does she?
I don't believe so, no. And, you know, so that's the tragic thing. I suppose, where do I find those things? Well, I do an awful lot of reading and research, but I suppose I have the kind of eye for that kind of detail.
And the memory.
Because
it just fascinates me
that... You know what? I think the fact that Robert Plant knew about Led Zeppelin getting back together again through Farmers Weekly tells you a lot about the kind of life lived by hugely successful rock stars. They all went and bought farms. What do you do if you bought a farm? You buy a magazine about running a farm, don't you? And then you read about Roy Harper, who's breeding sheep or something like that, I think he was. And, you know, so he was interviewed about his sheep, and he said, I've been talking to Jimmy Page. They're getting back together. So Rob Plant said, what? You know, that's the kind of thing that really interests me. And I hope it's the kind of thing that drives the narrative and sticks in people's minds.
Yeah, it does. You were saying earlier on that part of Rockstar's appeal was thinking that you could maybe go down to the pub with them and what, you know.
Yeah.
In your experience, you've interviewed many, many musicians over the years.
Can you?
Which musician have you had the best time with down the pub?
Well, it's very difficult to say because I get asked this a lot because I don't try to prevail upon them. I don't sort of say, you must come round to my house and meet my wife or whatever, you know, because I know that they're not going to do that. And, you know, they're meeting you in a professional capacity. There are some people who deal with that better than another. There's a wonderful story told about Bruce Springsteen. And he was on tour in the 80s. And he had a day off in Chicago. And so he went to the movies and in the afternoon. And he's sitting in the movie theatre. And he realises that the couple down the row are just looking at him, you know. And it's a... I think it's a brother and sister. They've gone to the movies and they're looking along the road going, crikey, that's Bruce Springsteen. And so at the end of the movie, they wait for him and he's coming out and they go, Bruce! And they get autographs or whatever. And they say, oh, such a shame. My dad's such a big fan. He'll never believe that we met you. And he says, where does he live? It's not that far away. He said, all right, I'll come with you. Because, and that's Bruce Springsteen. Because the genius thing about Bruce Springsteen, above and beyond anything musical, is nobody more profoundly understands the fan mindset than Bruce Springsteen. Because Bruce Springsteen made it quite late. You know, I've written about him in this book. He makes it when he's like 26, 27. Unlike Paul McCartney and all these guys, they'd done it when they were 19. It was different. It was harder for people like Bruce Springsteen. And so he never, in my experience, loses that idea of you're there to do a show for that person sitting in the furthest, least advantageous seat. You know, he said to me, I interviewed him once, and he said to me, the single most impressive thing I've ever heard a rock star say, he said, you have a responsibility to be living in the moment when 8 o'clock comes around. And I think that's just fantastic. It means you've got to be there, all there. Not half of you, completely focused. Because for the people out there, that's the only time they're going to do it. They haven't got another show tomorrow night. And so I think he has that, you know. But, I mean, most musicians that you talk to, as soon as you're not talking about them, they lose a bit of interest.
Right. The attention wavers a bit.
Because they've, you know... If you're Paul McCartney, from the age of 19, the conversation's been about you. Everything. You walk into a room. I've walked into a room with Mick Jagger, and let me tell you, and just standing to the side of him, you get an inkling of what it must be like to be Mick Jagger. Because if you walk into a room with Mick Jagger, everybody stops doing what they're doing. Doesn't matter who they are, world leaders, kids, fans, whatever. They stop and they just turn. And all they want to do is impress Mick Jagger. Mm. You know, the reason they call the Glimmer Twins is the idea, give them a glimmer. Just give them a little glimmer of your stardust, you know. Yeah. And you know, he deals with that as well as anybody can be expected to deal with it, you know. So I always say the musician I've been happiest talking to is Randy Newman. Because Randy Newman looks out at the world, doesn't just look in at what he's doing. Mm. And so Randy Newman is looking at everything and thinking, there's something in this. He'd be in this room tonight thinking, oh, there's a song here. Yeah. So, you know, he's got a different view.
Okay. We're going to play a little game, Glossop Record Club Roulette.
Whoa!
Right? All right.
This is such fun. I'm on the microphone. What am I abusing Paul McCartney for? I'm doing the same thing myself.
You don't know what's in here.
I don't. I've never met you before, no. Sir.
So if you give me a number between 1 and 9.
Oh, right, 8. We'll,
number 8. Okay. Right. Okay, interesting. So this relates back to your book.
I'm on this record, ladies and gentlemen. I don't get royalties. But, you know, you may have heard, you're no doubt familiar with, you know, the version of No Woman, No Cry that was a huge hit, live version. Bob Marley at the Lyceum on the 18th of July, 1975. And it starts with, you hear the crowd just going, whoa, well, that includes me and my mate Steve. And we went along to the show. We were, you know, big fans. I was working in a record shop in the West End of London at the time. And we were big fans of Bob Marley and the Wailers, as was anybody who was working in a record shop in London at the time. And he was, you know, people ask me, what's the best live show I ever saw? This was the best live show I ever saw.
What was it about the show? Because,
well, you've never heard that kind of music played live before. You'd never heard that kind of music played loud before. The kind of bottom of that sound with the, you know, the bass and the drums, it was just extraordinary. And on the top of it, there's Bob Marley, who was simultaneously, you know, kind of broadcasting from a distant planet owing to his removed consciousness for the amount of, you know, marijuana that was coursing through his system. But at the same time, did not miss a single accent of anything he was doing. Mm. He was utterly in control all the time. And they had very, very basic light show, which was just strobe lighting, which they would use from time to time. And he would, during the instrumentals, he would stride side to side, you know, knees up, arms up, and the strobe would hit him. And his dreads would just flicker. And I remember I went home that night. I had a few drinks. And I remember my wife still talks about it. I woke her up and did my impression of Bob Marley. Can you imagine how sad that was? And she had work to go to on the following morning, you know. And, but I still say it was the best I ever saw. And... and I'm so thrilled that there is a record there to prove me correct, you know, because nobody can argue with me.
Did you see any? Did you see him any other times after that? And was it ever anywhere near as good?
I did see him again. First time's always the best, you know, because you can't have that moment again, you know. Because as I say, you'd never heard anything like that. It wasn't. You weren't comparing it to other stuff because you thought, my God, because. Also, the thing about Bob Marley is he played some songs you knew and some songs you didn't know, and they were both equally familiar. Mm. He had that knack at that point, you know. He was incredibly catchy, Bob Marley, you know, which is, it's the thing I keep coming back to in both my books, that I do think the key issue of popular music is catchiness. It's not anything else. No, you don't get to write that many catchy songs. Most people don't get to do it. Mm. Bob Marley had a bunch of them at that point. It was extraordinary.
Do you want to play a tune from that, or do you want to give me another number?
Yeah, I'll give you another number.
Okay.
You know what Bob Marley sounds like now. And if you don't, you should be damn well ashamed of yourself. Two.
Number two. Okay. Oh, right, okay. So the this is the record, Pretender's first album, and this is a prop that Si's kindly brought in from he found in the loft. So we're talking about Live Aid. It's a question actually from Mark Ellen. I got in touch with Mark, and he said ask David about Billy Connolly's reaction to watching the Pretenders.
People ask me about Live Aid all the time and expecting me to say something moving or something. And I, you know, it's a job of work, and I was stuck in the Des Lynam commentary position at the top of the old Wembley Stadium. God, it was hot. It was such a warm day. And once they wired you in there, you couldn't leave. You couldn't go for a pee or anything like that. You were stuck. And, you know, and they just trundled in guests to sit on the sofa next to you, you know, to cover for anything that went down. And there was the famous occasion when I had a bunch of people on the sofa. I don't know. They might have been Andrew Ridgely might have been there. I can't remember. And then they cut away from me, and they just pushed somebody else onto the end of the sofa. And I looked down the sofa and I thought, who's that? And so when I wasn't on camera, I turned to the production assistant who'd produced this person, and I went, who's that? And she said, and so I thought, God almighty. Golden rule of television. The presenter always looks stupid. The presenter is never to blame. It's always people behind that. And anyway, I thought, oh God, I'm going to have to jump. I went, so we've been joined by Ian Asprey of The Cult. Thank God that was correct. Because I'm no expert on Ian Asprey of The Cult. Anyway, the story about Billy Connolly. The Pretenders were playing. And that was the time when they'd lost two members, James Honeyman Scott and Pete Farndon, and both died drug-related. Mm. And I was, Billy Connolly and Pamela Stevenson were up there with me. And Connolly looked at the stage and said, I wouldn't have joined that group. And I said, why not? Nobody leaves. It's still my favourite memory of Live Oak. I think about that. You know, I think about that more than Bob Geldof swearing at me in front of the world's largest television audience. Because they, you know, the directors, producers, they talk to you in your ear and they say nothing any use at all. You know, at one point they came, we're coming to you in a moment, David, and you are now broadcasting to the largest television audience in history. And you think that's no help to anybody at all, you know. And so Bob Geldof swears. He doesn't say, give us your fucking money, despite what I've been told by cab drivers all over the world, who all swear he did. He didn't. He said, fuck the address for very complicated, boring reasons. And all I could think was, did he just swear? Was that? I think he did. And is this the world's largest television audience? Yeah, I do believe it is. And amongst the world's largest television audience is my mum watching that. Of course she was. And yeah. And the following day, I only realised how big Live Aid was afterwards. Hmm. So when I went home, and my wife, on this occasion, was awake, said, well, that was extraordinary. Oh, was it? She said, yeah, your mum and dad were watching it. My mum and dad were watching it. And more people watching during the day, you know, to kind of gather during the day. That's which you don't know when you're at Wembley Stadium. And the following morning, I had volunteered to interview the great Clive Lloyd, the cricketer, at Lord's for a series that they had where people picked their favourite tunes. And I turn up at Lord's and Clive Lloyd goes, yeah, Live Aid. And I think it's Clive Lloyd for crying out loud. He says, it was amazing. It was extraordinary. I said, were you watching it? Did you have a match? He said, I had guys trying to get out in order to watch Live Aid. You know, so the ripples spread like that.
Did you get much sleep the night before? How petrifying was it?
Only as standard petrified as you were in doing anything like that, right. Really. I don't, you know, beyond a certain number, it doesn't make a huge amount of difference. You know, Mark Allen and I used to do whistle tests live a lot of the time, and we used to pace about, you know, just where the continuity announcer was saying, and now the snooker's finally over. And we find out what's happening in the rock scene and around, and the music started. And Mark and I would look at each other and say, if you could go home now, would you go?
Yeah. And we go, yeah.
Definitely. But it's sheer terror that makes you do these things. You know, it's kind of conquering the terror, I suppose. It's all nice afterwards.
Another number.
Number three.
Oh, well, talking of whistle test, it's another Mark Allen question, actually.
Oh, my God.
It's an REM compilation, because obviously there's a great clip of you introducing them. But Mark's question is, he said, whistle test tends to be remembered for the high points when it was ahead of the game, the Wailers, ZZ Top, REM, Captain Beefheart, Roxy Music. But it also had a shameful reputation for getting it completely wrong. He says, you should ask Dave to list some of the bands we had on in our day that plummeted to obscurity directly after. It's funny if you remember them. It's funny if you don't.
Oh, well, we always used to say, you know, we always used to joke, it was never REM, it was Kissing the Pink.
Oh, yes, I remember
that. You know, it was never Joni Mitchell, it was Annabelle Lamb. You know, all these people you've probably forgotten about. I went for a thing I was working on recently, I went and looked at a load of old Radio Times listings, and I read the names of these groups and think, did I introduce these? I, you know, I can't remember at all, because it was all a question of who you could get.
Mm.
And, you know, people didn't want to do the whistle test. The big acts thought they were above it. The younger acts thought they were too hip for it. And also, it demanded that they be quite technically competent.
Mm.
And so, you know, the prospect of doing a live show at 11:15 at night, what's likely to happen? It might go wrong, you know. You might not be as good as you think you are. The sound may go wrong or something. And so a lot of people just really kept clear of it, you know. And so we could never quite get who we wanted. But that's just the way it is, you know. Nowadays, it's extraordinary. You know, people send me links on social media saying, "You interviewed Santa." I said, "No, I bloody didn't. No memory of doing that at all." "Yes, she did." And they sent me a link. And like, crikey Moses, that's me and Mark Ellen and Kate Bush. And then slowly, I begin to piece it together, you know.
Yeah.
We interviewed Kate Bush, and we didn't really want to do it. Which is extraordinary now, if you think about it. You know, Kate Bush, clear the schedules. People do anything for Kate Bush. At the time, you know, she was somebody who'd had a couple of hits. And then she was making Strange Aboriginal records and, you know, Rolf Harris was the guest musician on. Yeah. And you see, now we all sneer at Rolf Harris. But she they had to get her on Whistle Test in order to introduce her new video. And Whistle Test at the time was done in Manchester, so she had to come from London to Manchester to do it. She didn't want to do it because she had to rehearse for her new video. And so Malcolm Hill, who was the promo man at the time, he arranged for a train carriage, a guard's van, to be cleared on the train from Euston to Piccadilly, Manchester Piccadilly, so that she could practice. And I thought, did that really happen? And so a few weeks ago, Malcolm Hill, who now lives in Australia, is kind of old mate of mine, and I, "Malcolm, I just imagine that?" And he goes, "Oh, yes, it absolutely happened. Turned up at Euston, bribed the guard, cleared the guard's van. In she went with two dancers and a boombox and danced all the way up to Manchester Piccadilly." Again, well, Beyonce wouldn't do that. No. So, you know, there were loads of terrible groups that I've suppressed, you know, in my memory, but occasionally I kind of wake in the middle of the night in a lather, in a fetal position, and go, "I've got to introduce Kissing the Pink in 2 minutes.
Jimmy the Hoover.
Jimmy the Hoover. Well, Mark Ellen should talk. He put Jimmy the Hoover on the cover of Smash Hits. At the time, the biggest selling edition of Smash Hits had on the cover Derek Dunbar of Jimmy the Hoover, who nobody remembers to this day. But, you know, Mark and I have always had great fun talking about failures, because that's one of the fascinating things about covering pop music. It's not the ones that make it.
No, it's far more interesting.
Far more interesting. It's the idea of the people who aimed low and missed.
Mm.
It's always really appealed to me.
Fallen off the giddy carousel of pop.
Yes. Well, that was it. We used to, with Smash Hits days, we used to, I think Neil Tennant, actually, who works at Smash Hits, was the poet of this particular area, that used to talk about, you know, you were either huge or you were in the dumper.
Mm.
Or you were, you know, those were the two wings of popular music success. You're enormous, or there's the dumper. And you were either going from the dumper up to there, or you're more likely you're going from there down to the dumper, you know. And so he would develop these incredibly ornate ways of referring, of calibrating exactly how far from the dumper, you know, somebody was. And I was talking about this the other night, and the most extraordinary case of this is that, of course, Bob Geldof, before the Band-Aid single, there was nobody more mired in the dumper.
He lived in the dumper. He'd had residence there for some time, hadn't he?
He'd had his period in the sun, and then it had all just stopped, and he was in the dumper. And when I, you know, Whistle Test said to me, "Bob Geldof's making a charity record," I said, "Sorry, repeat that? Bob Geldof's making a charity record." "Oh, yes. And he's got loads of stars, and they're going to be at Psalm Studios tomorrow morning. Will you go down there with film crew Sunday morning nothing. This is going to be a complete waste of time. You know, there will be one member of Bananarama. There will be Alan Lancaster out of Status Quo. And, you know, Johnny Fingers, Kissing the Pig will probably turn up.
Jimmy the Hoover.
Jimmy the Hoover. And they were just terrible. I thought, but I'll go. Okay. And I go there, and the first I go in the door, first person I see is Paul Weller. Oh, Sting. Oh, Bono. Oh, everybody. Yeah. They were all just there. And, of course, the amazing thing to me was that, you know, obviously the Band-Aid was an enormous success, and then the leads to Live Aid. And so within 6 months, Bob Geldof has gone from the mayor of the dumper, yes, for life, to being a person, you know, where the Daily Mirror on the front page is calling for him to be given the Nobel Peace Prize. Yes? What other profession, other than rock star, seriously, could that happen? Just simply couldn't happen anywhere else. That's the strange lot of the rock star. You know, which I've written a chapter about Bob Geldof in my book, because that day is just an absolutely extraordinary piece of theatre. You know, for not just Bob Geldof, and of course, you know, the U2 set at Live Aid. So they're all playing in the back line. You know, Smash Hits were always known as Smash Hits. U2 were always known as Smash Hits as. Was it Bobo the Hedge? Bobo the Hedge, Larry Mullen Jr., and the other one. and so they were playing, you know, they tethered to his drum kit at the back, he's playing the bass player, you know, and the Hedge is, you know, giving it loads. And Bobo disappears off the really, really high stage. And just sets off. He's on live international television. He's going to attempt some moment of communion with the audience. He knows not what he's going to do. I'm perfectly serious. There's no plan. There's no plan at all. He goes. He disappears. The band don't know where the bloody hell he is. What is going on? They're just churning away. And then finally, gets back on stage. They don't get to do the third number. They go off stage. They don't talk to each other. They think their career is completely over. Instead, it made them. That moment of mad theatre of Bobo going down there, embraced, you know, the girls out of the audience. He was like the Pope. Come to me. Extraordinary.
Right, give us another number.
One.
It's another Mark Allen one.
Oh,
sorry. You've had one, two, and three.
Why don't you get Mark Allen?
Yeah, maybe.
You tried, didn't you? Bloody killer.
He's rumbled us.
I'm going to ring him now.
This is about Smash Hits, so I chose Adam and the Ants because they were a big band at in the heyday of Smash Hits. And he said to ask you about the time Jimmy Percy dropped by the Smash Hits office to warmly discuss your review of their latest single.
Yeah, well, that was in the days when people just turned up in the office. And, you know, you frequently got callers. Boy George used to work in a shop round the corner. And Boy George used to just come in and he used to think, who's this weird bloke? And then 2 years later, he's the biggest pop star on God's earth, you know. And, Jimmy Percy. I don't know if it was me that wrote something unkind about him or somebody else, I can't remember. But he appeared in my office doorway, unannounced. In those days, there was no security or anything of that nature. And he kind of pinned me to the door and said, don't you ever mention my group ever again. And that's a wish with which I've been happy to comply. That is not as threatening as the worst threat I've had was after I read a thing for Sounds. I went to do a thing for Sounds about Lena Lovitch, who was making a film in Holland with Nina Hagen. Remember Nina Hagen? And security was provided on the film set by the Dutch Hells Angels. And I foolishly passed on some story about what had happened to one of them in order to give this story a bit of colour. And I just happened to be in the sound's office. And one day, reception rang up. And it's the single most chilling message I've ever had on the phone. David Hepworth, yes? The Dutch Hells Angels are downstairs to see you. There's no escape, you know, you can't, you're not going out of fire escape. There's no, oh, for God's sake. I was about 26 years old or something like that. And I just had to, you know, surrender myself to the Dutch Hells Angels, who thankfully restricted themselves to giving me a stern talking to. Nothing, there were no tire irons or anything like that, but you have not lived until reception have rung you and said, Dutch Hells Angels are downstairs to see you, yeah.
So that's a life well lived, anyway. Whatever question you pick next, I swear, Mark Ellen's got nothing to do with it. So,
good.
If you choose, let's see. Do you want to? Would you like a question about Uncommon People or 1971?
I don't mind.
You don't mind. All right. Well, give me any number then between 4 and 9, but not 8.
9.
Okay, that's Uncommon People. We've got a Black Sabbath single here. So
the Sabs.
The Sabs. There we go. Paranoid and the Wizard on the other side. So in the 1969 chapter of Uncommon People, you talk about the Sabs. And you make an interesting point, I think, about the names of bands. It's something that kind of seems obvious, but I'd never really thought about before, about how a lot of groups, like the Miracles, the Temptations and the Supremes, you say they hint at sensuality and delight.
Yeah.
And then you've got a different kind of vibe going on with Moby Grape and Blodwyn Pig. There's a nice line you say, they hung out the shingle reading Members Only, which I like. It's like it's quite impenetrable kind of names. Yeah. And then you talk about Black Sabbath and say that they were exclusively playing just that one kind of music, and it was a narrow scene, but they kept going at it. And
well, my point about Black Sabbath is kind of a bit like my point about Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan's key creative act in his entire life was to call himself Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan was Robert Zimmerman from Minnesota, leaves Minnesota, arrives in New York, he's Bob Dylan. And people say, where did you come from? He said, I ran away with the circus when I was 13. You know, I rode the freight trains. I was taught guitar by a one-eyed black man called Wigglefoot. Rubbish. Complete rubbish. Nobody argued because everybody wanted to believe in him. And so Bob Dylan invented Bob Dylan. And Joni Mitchell, not long ago, actually said, it's all right for Bob. He has that guy to sing the songs for him. And I think it's a really good point. It's a character. Okay, on a less elevated level, the members of Earth, Birmingham group, were standing outside a rehearsal hall in Birmingham. One of them looked at a movie theatre across the road, which was playing a film called Black Sabbath. And they thought, that's a good name. And wouldn't it be interesting to do music like people do films like that, which is do music that's frightening and dark and has no romance about it at all. And so the key creative decision, I think, of that group is to call themselves Black Sabbath. And then all they had to do was to spend the next 40 years making the kind of music you would expect a group called Black Sabbath to make. You know, they're not going to turn up and do a funk tune, are they? They're not going to suddenly go, oh, the bass player's written some lyrical tunes about his cat. You know, it's not going to happen. You know what you're going to get with Black Sabbath. It's branding, isn't it? And it can be quite narrow. And so what Black Sabbath did, it seems to me, was incredibly narrow, but appealed very profoundly to some people. And, you know, it's lasted up until quite recently, hasn't it? Mm. I mean, they've only recently stopped.
Are they actually stopped now?
Right. It's probably not safe to say that they're stopped. Somebody will have a divorce or something that will,
get them back together one last time.
On the road one last time because, you know, what else are they going to do? You know, people ask me all the time, why do bands still do it when they're in their 60s and 70s and so forth? And I always say, if Bobby Charlton could put on a Man United strip and turn out on Saturday, would he? Yes. Okay. Mick Jagger can do that. Yes. He can go out for more money in front of more people than he did when he was 19. Wouldn't you all do that? I think you would. Okay. I don't think we need to search any further for motivations. They do it because they can. Their film star brethren can't. Nobody's paying Robert Redford to make a major movie in the year 2018. Mm. It doesn't apply anywhere else. It applies in the world of rock. And what's interesting to me is that people go and see The Stones, or they go and see Bruce Springsteen, or these people are in the 60s and 70s. And what they're seeing in their heads as they watch them is the 25-year-old version. Mm. Because that's where the powerful brand is, you know what I mean? They're not really looking at the 72-year-old.
That's an incredible brand loyalty, isn't it?
They're seeing that. They're seeing the Rolling Stones, you know, as on the cover of, you know, Brown Sugar or whatever. That's what they see. That endures. Because the mystique, you know, careers in music, in rock music, can last a long time, but inspiration is quite fleeting. So the period during which they wrote really good songs is quite short. But if your mystique is strong enough, you can trade on the mystique for years and years and years. And so the Enemy, you know, closed its doors the other week. And the people who ought to be saying thank you to the Enemy but won't are the record business. Mm. Because what the Enemy did was make bands who were kind of all right really exciting. If you want to know who invented the Clash, Penny Smith invented the Clash. Penny Smith took the photographs for the Enemy that made the Clash look like the coolest thing you'd ever seen in your life. And then they went away and they made the music that fitted the photographs. You know, these things, I think they had a huge role, the Enemy particularly, in creating that mystique. And the mystique lasts long after the hits have stopped. And the mystique is what sells 50, 60 pound and more expensive tickets to see bigger and bigger shows.
That's what stays in the memory, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It's that dream.
We should really talk maybe about 1971 a little bit. Give me a number between 4 and 6 and then we're guaranteed.
5.
Number 5.
Would that be 5?
It's Mark Ellen's favourite record. No, it's not Mark Ellen.
Oh, bloody kill it.
I got in touch. Carole King, Tapestry.
Carole King, Tapestry. Well, many things. Most famous cat in entertainment. Seriously. Cat called Telemachus, okay? No doubt long gone. No doubt, you know, turned up her paws many years ago. But the Carole King story fascinates me because she'd obviously been around. She'd written hugely successful songwriter in the 60s. And Lou Adler, who produced this record, he first of all used to represent her publisher. So he used to take her demos round to get her songs covered by, I don't know, Aretha Franklin, all kinds of people. And he noticed that people always hung on to her demos because they liked the sound of them. Because I think he says that Carole King has the voice that every woman likes to think she has. I think it's a really good point. It's a kind of modest voice. You couldn't persuade yourself that you had Aretha Franklin's voice, but you could persuade yourself you had Carole King's voice because it's modest, it's sincere, it's engaging. And he made this record. And what's fascinating to me about listening back to it is it sounds like a demo. It sort of doesn't sound finished, which is the great thing about it. It's not over-arranged, it's not polished, you know. You can kind of supply the missing bits yourself, you know. And it came out and on Valentine's Day 1971. And by the summer, I think it was selling 150,000 copies a week in the United States alone. Just gives you an idea of what it's like. The record business was utterly exploding. And a large number of large proportion of the people who bought this, I remember from my experience in England, were women. That, you know, they got their first flat or whatever. And the first item of furniture you got in the flat before a cooker or anything was a record player. And then the second thing you got was a copy of Carol King's Tapestry to play on it. And it's a remarkable kind of combination of personal inspiration and also kind of hack work, because the last track is You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, which you no doubt know from Aretha Franklin's version. And it's fascinating to me how that song came out as a masterful record. God knows it's a wonderful record. But it came to be because Jerry Wexler of Atlantic Records, it came to him in a dream that he wanted Aretha Franklin to write to sing a song called Natural Woman. And so he bumped into Jerry Goffin and Carole King in New York, and he said, "You, write me a song called Natural Woman for Aretha." And so they did. And who writes the words about "You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman"? A man. Jerry Goffin, you know, wasn't Carole King at all. And but, you know, it fascinates me because I think one of the things that fascinates me about musicians is they don't have pure motives, ever. Mm. They have mixed motives. There's always loads and loads of things going on at the same time. There's creativity, there's ambition, there's, you know, cheap advantage, there's showing off to the rest of them, there's making a bit of money. There's all those things going on at the same time. And I think there's a tendency for people to forget that. And that's what I try to do in my books. And, you know, I love this record. It's an absolutely extraordinary thing. And and although it was selling 150,000 copies a week in the United States, she still put out another one that year, okay? Because in those days, people were putting out two albums a year. Paul McCartney, 1971, two albums. Elton John, four. That's Elton. They did things really quickly. David Bowie, you know, in 1971, he makes... in 1971, he goes to America in February, and he has a life-changing experience in going to America like everybody did in those days, your first visit to America and so forth. No doubt slept with loads of people he shouldn't have slept with. And heard Iggy Pop, and you know, got to a Velvet Underground gig, and got backstage and buttonholed the singer and told him how thrilled he was to finally meet him. And only afterwards did he realise he wasn't talking to Lou Reed at all, because Lou Reed had left the group. He was talking to Doug Yule, might have been as well as being talking to a painter and decorator, because in those days you just didn't know. You know, you saw a picture, maybe, in the Melody Maker. You know, Jim Morrison dies in 1971. How long does it take to get in the papers in Britain? 2 weeks. After the first week's Melody Maker has a little story saying, "We've heard that Jim Morrison might have died, but we're not sure." And it's only a week later.
Yep.
Are they able to confirm it? He's gone. You know, whereas nowadays, you know, things travel at completely uncontrollable speed. Sorry, okay. David Bowie. Yeah, I'll finish my story about David Bowie. So he goes, he's in States, changes his head, comes back, records and releases Hunky Dory. Before Hunky Dory has come out, he has recorded all but one track of Ziggy Stardust from the Spiders from Mars. So my point is, if all you knew about David Bowie was what he did in 1971, you'd know an awful lot about David Bowie. Yeah? Because they worked really quickly. They didn't second guess. They thought it would go on forever. Hmm. They thought, oh, it's easy, this. A few years later, they found it wasn't. And that's when they started trying to do again what they'd done naturally. And that's a really hard thing to do.
You you say on the inside dust jacket of Uncommon People that the best 45 ever...
Is that?
Is this You Never Can Tell by Chuck Berry.
By Chuck Berry.
Why?
Well, loads of reasons. It's the most beautiful label any record ever had. It came out... Chuck Berry had gone to jail, as you know, for transporting a minor over a state line for immoral purposes, although he claimed it was to preserve her from immoral purposes. That's Chuck. First gig I ever went to see, Chuck Berry at the Bradford Gaumont. Yeah, it's been completely downhill ever since. And so he comes out and he has this brief purple patch. He has no particular place to go. He has the promised land. And above all, he has this, you never can tell. And what I love about it is it's a wonderful sentimental song about a couple, a young teenage couple, who get married and they set up home together. And it's got wonderful language in it, which some of you may no doubt be aware of, you know. The coolerator was filled with TV dinners and ginger ale. Well, when the sun went down, the rapid tempo of the music fell. C'est la vie, say the old folks. It goes to show you never can tell. It's the most charming record you've ever heard, and it's made by the most cynical shit who ever drew breath. Okay? And that's really important to remember. You know, don't worship the people who do it. Worship the art. And this is a wonderful thing. And when my daughter got married a few years ago, she and her husband, this was their first dance at the wedding. So that completed my particular circle. That's why this is the greatest record ever made.
It was a teenage wedding and the old folks wished them well.
And there are people who say it actually, Chuck Berry didn't write it. It was Johnny Johnson, his piano player, because it sounds like a piano tune, actually. But it's a wonderful record.
Okay, so I think we've reached that time in the evening where we can take some questions from the great and the good of Glossop. Is there anyone who'd like to start?
Are they coming?
Hey! Brett.
Hello there. Long-time listener, first time caller.
Oh, very good.
I was born in 1971, towards the tail end of 1971, and I love the book, and you make the case brilliantly, but I was born in December 1971, and I thought, I wonder what David's going to say about the last hit that took us through into 1972. Number one, the day I was born, Benny Hill. I'm known in Glossop Record Club for something of a comedy
man. Okay. I've already warned you about him, haven't
yeah.
I?
I said in all innocence, I said, is there anybody interested in comedy records? And they said, funny you should say that.
This was before, it was re-released 72 with Ernie on the front cover.
Well, we all know that,
this
Brett.
This is the 71 original. But my point, and it is a serious one, I think Benny Hill changed music fundamentally. My point is, Benny Hill was an over-the-hill comedian who didn't want to appear on Top of the Pops, so he came up with this brilliant idea that
a video,
the music video,
yeah.
And it is largely credited Queen, Bohemian Rhapsody, that 2 years later. My contention would be Benny Hill kind of invented the pop video.
Okay, very good. Well, in the next edition, I shall make sure that this egregious omission is corrected. And actually, I do remember very clearly that record because my mother bought it from my father because he was called Ernie. Okay, so it was played in our household around about Christmas. And I think it's kind of important thing about pop music that you should have. I mourn the passing of the comedy record because I think variety was a hugely important component of popular music. You heard all kinds of things. You heard things your parents liked. You heard stuff you liked, you know. And so I think a chart, I think Paul Morley said this years ago, the great thing about charts, it gives you things to like and things to dislike. And I think that's a really good point, you know. Yeah. And so I'm happy to admit Ernie into the canon.
Well, I follow your Spotify playlist, and when it's on there.
Okay.
I think also looking at charts in the '70s wasn't just the comedy, but you could have disco living alongside punk.
Absolutely.
Alongside glam, alongside prog, alongside rock, and there was even a retro '50s thing going on in the '70s.
Well, I think Danny Baker says this. You know that between, I don't know, 1969 and 1979. It's just staggering how much went on so quickly. Because, You know, people nowadays are used to saying, oh, pop music moves so fast nowadays. No, it doesn't. It moves really slowly nowadays. It used to move really quickly. It's now completely controlled because everybody's trying to eke out their career as long as they can. Whereas at the time, they were just dealing the next card, you know.
Yeah, he didn't know what tomorrow would bring.
They did not know what was going to happen at all.
And I think also people buy records. Like Clive Dunn, I think, is the classic example where...
I'm sorry.
You're aware of the works of Dunn.
I am a great admirer of the Dunster.
Well, but Holy Flowers could go 1 week from Walk on the Wild Side.
Absolutely.
But it came in the charts for around 26 weeks because in the run-up to Christmas, granddads bought it for their children.
Yeah.
In the after Christmas, children bought it for their granddads.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing never went away. The families bought records.
Yeah.
Women, as you said.
Well, also, the Top of the Pops experience was, you know, Top of the Pops was the kind of crucible of all this. And the Top of the Pops was family viewing. And so your kind of... your experience of the things you loved was inevitably accompanied by the proximity of your father, who would inevitably say one of two things. He would say, "You call this music?" And what's the other thing you would say?
Is it
a boy or is it a girl? There you go. And so you sat there trying to, you know, gather this bit of delight, this morsel of delight in the presence of this person who was just about to lower your scene in the worst possible way, your own flesh and blood, you know. Whereas I feel sorry for kids today. They don't have that, you know. They've headphones on, they're in their world, you know. Nobody interferes in their world at all. Whereas your dad used to interfere in your world all the time.
My dad always used to refer to a certain band where the drummer was Fishface and the bass player was Donkeyface. Can you imagine who they would be?
I don't know. I did the Rolling Stones. My mother used to say, when Mick Jagger, she used to say, oh, he's got a mouth like a set pot. I never, to this day, have worked out what a set pot was, but I think she was... It was suggesting it was quite big.
Yeah, I imagine that's what she's getting at.
Yeah, it was part of the experience. Part of the experience, yes.
I'll shut up now.
Yeah, thank you. Bill.
When I used to buy a single record on a Saturday morning and take it home, my father used to say, "Is it a shouter?"
Yeah.
"Yes, Dad, it's a shouter."
Yeah, and he'd go away if he thought it was a shouter. He'd have no interest.
The other thing I want to, or hopefully, I watched the live transmission. Now, at 75 years old, my memory is beginning to leak daily. Was there a break in television transmission in the afternoon due to, you know, atmospheric conditions?
Not that I'm aware of, but I wouldn't necessarily be aware of because I was there rather than...
Well, I think that's happened. And I think the Hollies were supposed to be on.
Don't think so.
I don't know.
I'll tell you one thing from Live Aid, actually, that does involve a comedy record. Sorry, it just occurred to me. Steve Blacknell, one of the presenters, the arrangement was Phil Collins, you may remember, was playing in London with whoever, and then he was getting on Concorde to go and play and Led Zeppelin. And Steve Blacknell was given the job of going, "You're not going to be a Live Aid, Steve. Instead, you're going to fly on Concorde with Phil Collins and you're going to do some kind of link via the cockpit," as they could do it in those days, to back to the studio. And Steve and I were both fans of Tony Hancock. And so when Steve came over the link and I was the presenter, the first word spoken was, I think he said, "Send a tray of bread pudding to Kuala Lumpur." Which, for the benefit of those who don't know it, is about the Tony Hancock, the radio ham, you know, where he's, you know, "I've got friends all over the world. None in this country, but friends all over the world." You know, so Steve and I had quite a bit of banter, you know, "It is our not raining in Tokyo also. Now can we speak to Phil Collins?"
Now, when you mentioned the lyrics of Tutti Frutti by Little Richard, Also around about, well, slightly later than that, Buddy Holly had a record called Midnight Shift, which was the theme of which was prostitution.
All right.
And yet he just
gave the yeah, well, they probably didn't realise. Well, it's like a bit bizarrely enough. I mean, Walk on the Wild Side. It's still amazing to me.
Working on the midnight shift.
Well, they probably thought it was, you know, it was the car workers. And, yeah, Rosie the Riveter or something. I don't know. You know, people thought innocent things
innocent
in those
times.
And then, you know, even when Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side, they thought, you know, that's innocent.
Surely.
Better times.
Any other questions? Yes, gentlemen.
Just kind of interested, what's the most recent thing that you've been most excited by musically?
Whatever kind of pops up on my iPod. I listen to a lot of sort of country. I listen to Jason Isbell and John Morland, people like that. I listen to a fair bit of hip-hop. And very often I don't know what I'm listening to at all. It just sounds all right to me. But I listen to all sorts of stuff. I don't revere new stuff. You know, because as far as I often think there's no such thing as new stuff. There's just old stuff you never heard before. Because, you know, I only recently discovered Louis Armstrong's Hot Fives, you know. And that's just extraordinary music. And, you know, great music lives in the now. Great recordings live in the now. You know, I don't go chasing over new bands, all that sort of stuff, as if it's a kind of virtuous thing, you know. I'll leave that to other people. I'm an elderly chap.
You've done your time.
I've done my time. And also, all music is more available now than it's ever been. And it's a different mechanic, isn't it? Music used to be recorded music, used to be hard to find, difficult to afford, easy to damage, and consequently highly valued. Now it's impossible to escape, costs nothing, indestructible, and is not valued at all.
So what do you think of the whole sort of record shop day and vinyl revival?
Well, I'm sure there's a market for kind of artisan cheese as well, you know. But I don't fool myself that it's going to take over the world. I mean, it's there. Of course it's there. And, you know, I can't personally bring myself to spend £25 on a kind of 180-gram vinyl version of a record that I know damn well was sitting in a bargain bin for most of the 80s and 90s and no bugger wanted it at all. You know, all the same stuff. Suddenly, ooh, you know, pristine. You know, you get in a Hoxton and you see people walking down the road carrying copies of Led Zeppelin 2. Just openly. You know, they're kind of 24-year-olds. Just showing off that they got it. But I suppose that just indicates that one of the important things about records used to be the kind of the display side of them. And that's gone because music's disappeared into your headphones. I try to explain to people what it was like to take an LP record to school in 1966. You shook with excitement. You did. You got on the bus and think, people would look, what is it? I've never seen that before. People try to get closer, you know. It was a signifier, it was a poster that you carried around, you know. You advertised yourself through the ownership of LPs. I suppose that's one of the reasons why it's back, you know. But I don't personally subscribe to it in a big way.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this. You know the Smash Hits magazine?
I do.
Good question.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Publishing the lyrics in there.
Yeah.
You had to pay the publisher.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
So was it expensive to do that? Or did the publishers of the lyrics, you know, which was...
No, it was quite expensive.
Oh.
And
why didn't they think, well, we'll let them publish the lyrics for nothing?
No, because publishers just want to make money, you know, they'll make it however they can. And I don't blame them for that. We always used to have difficulty with certain publishers. So EMI Music Publishing wanted to be paid more than everybody else, which is why I think in the heyday of Adam and the Ants, on occasion, we didn't have Adam's lyrics because they were published by EMI Music. But no, it was, I think we paid 150 per or something, which at the time was, and you were doing 15 lyrics, I think.
Yeah.
It was significant money.
I mean, my record collection, all the punk rock records, all the 45s, every one of them, the picture packets, have got smash hits folded up in four. It's fascinating. You look at them records now, because I've not looked at them for years and years, and when I look at them now, or I brought them here one night when we had the punk rock new wave night, and every one of them got the lyrics out smashed up inside.
Of course, the funny thing about asking a publisher for the lyrics is they'd say, fine, give us the money, you can publish the lyrics. And we'd go, do you have the lyrics? And they go, no. And so, you know, Bev Hillier would have to sit there and, you know, transcribe the exact precise number of baby babies, you know. and somebody would have to get the headphones on and you check the lyrics, you know. The thing I remember most about Smash Hits is just how hard we worked to kind of, because to please the readers, you know. That was the weird thing. I was thinking about it recently. When I was editor of sort of 81, 82, I reintroduced the readers' poll because nobody had one at the time. And I thought, that'd be a good thing to do. And so we published a thing in the magazine, fill this in, favourite record, most fanciful male, most fanciful female, most very horrible thing, you know, all the stuff. 45,000 people sent those things back. And let me tell you, every last one was counted. We came in weekends and we counted. Somebody going, now how many crosses have you got in the column? Are you sure you got that right? Because shouldn't John Taylor win that? How can it possibly be Les Neems out of Haircut 100 or what? And we did this. We were incredibly diligent and thorough, you know, because we couldn't believe how popular it was.
The crossword, the
crossword. Fred Deller did the Smash Hits crossword. Yeah. Fred Deller, the guy who got me the job at Smash Hits. Sorry.
Sorry, David. I was just going to ask a question. It was actually related to Brett's assertion that Benny Hill was the precursor of the rock video. And I have a recollection that David Bowie did a video to The Laughing Gnome. I just wanted to know whether I'm mistaken in that assertion.
I'm not aware.
You are mistaken.
You are silent. I'm pretty sure that I remember seeing...
Well, that was the flower problem.
I'm pretty sure that I remember seeing...
I don't know that. But let's just settle this once and for all. Actually, the inventor of the video was the Beatles with Penny Lane, Strawberry Fields Forever.
Yeah.
Surely.
Yeah.
With a major, proper filmmaker. Sorry?
That was later.
That was later. That was put together, wasn't it? Yeah. Because in Hello Goodbye, is it the Hello Goodbye video when they're not actually singing Hello Goodbye? It's one of those things.
That's Lady Madonna.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's put together from the sessions of Hey Bulldog. Sorry.
Not boring you, are we?
I'll just stroke my chest.
Gentlemen, the back there.
The show about GLR.
Yeah.
Chris Morris's very short-lived Name That Git.
Chris Evans.
So, who is the most unpleasant person you've ever had to deal with?
Oh, what a question.
Well, that's a good one.
Should we turn the mics off for this one? You can mime it.
Apart from the Dutch girl,
well, Van Morrison, you know. I mean, you know. But Van, he's kind of almost got to the point where you think he's got a problem, really, you know. Yeah, well, we did a Q Awards once. When would this be? Late 80s, early 90s. And we had, it was so star-studded, the Q Awards, you know. I think Cher was there, Eric Clapton was there, U2 was there, Tony Blair was there, Madonna might have been there. Who was the only person who demanded to be allowed into the building via the kitchens? Van bloody Morrison. And we're all thinking, Van Morrison going through the kitchen, somebody's going to think he's a washer-up. You know the old story about Van Morrison at the Blues Festival? there's a blues festival down at Devon, I think. It takes place at some stately home. And Vans amongst the people playing. And there's a party in the house afterwards. And Van appears at the door, rings the doorbell. And somebody goes, opens the door, looks, goes, "Who called for a cab?" You know, he's just got that look about him, you know. But so, Van, I was, you know, the gentleman there, I was just recalling it, the glory days of GLR, that Chris Evans came up with this TV, this radio format called Name That Git. He said, if you ring me up and you'd like to name a git in your life, I'll name them. And so somebody rings up and goes, I was going out with this bloke and he told me he wasn't married. And then he turned out to be married. All right, name that git. He was, and surely did, you know. And I was listening, I was driving around saying, so I can't believe he's just done that. And he never got a second, you know. They didn't do that again.
I think we've got time for maybe one or two more quick ones.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, David, where you used to buy your records from when you grew up in
Dewsbury. Wakefield, mainly.
The Wakefield
Record Bar. Mm-hmm. And I've written a chapter in a new book I'm working on just about buying Sgt. Pepper in the Wakefield Record Bar on the day it came out from the lady and gentleman who ran it called Ken and Betty. So, yeah, I used to go there. But Orty's in Dewsbury will probably mean... Orty's in the arcade in Dewsbury.
And did you ever have ice cream at Caddy's?
Oh, certainly did. I only talking about it the other day. Finest ice cream in the world.
Did you ever buy this record, Dave? Because I've actually bought it for you. It's by the Hepworth.
Very good. But I shall... Well, no... I don't have a copy, sir. How kind. I am. Words fail me. I shall treasure this as a memento.
That may be a good. Oh, go on. Let's have one more question, Pete.
Okay. Can we please know that you are the second celebrity that we've had who fingered Van Morrison,
probably the
most unpleasant.
Would the first one be Paul
Dunoyer? Yes.
And did he tell the story about Spike Milligan?
Spike, yeah.
Always a difficult man. Paul Dunoyer, I was quoting where we had dinner earlier, and I'm going to pass on Paul Dunoyer, funniest man in rock. And I worked with Paul for many years. And Paul used to refer to when he had a hangover. He used to say, "I'm wearing the iron hat." And on one day he appeared in the office looking particularly worse for wear. And Mark said to him, "Are you wearing the iron hat today, Paul?" And Paul said, "When I awoke this morning, a wide array of metal millinery was arrayed around my bed. I chose the Spanish conquistador's helmet, which I am wearing at a rakish tilt." That's a writer, ladies and gentlemen. He did that out of his head. Great man.
So I think there's nothing left for me to do except say a very big thank you, David, for coming to Glossop. Thank you very much.
It's been enormous fun. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's been great.